Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Big talk, empty words. How else to interpret the contradictory pronouncements coming out of European capitals on the subject of Ukraine? Bluster and threats are not a coherent policy. In fact, it is an indication of panic. Meanwhile, remember, Russia does not bluff. It acts. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Anthony Weber in Worthing. He is an independent political commentator. In Belgrade, we go to Stephen Gajic. He is a research associate at Belgrade's Institute of European Studies. And in Lisbon, we cross to Alexander Guerrero. He is an international legal analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate. Stephen, let me go to you first in Belgrade. As an outside observer, like I am, of all this going on in Europe, who's speaking for whom, and what is the message when it comes to Ukraine? Stephen.
Well, that is a very good question, because we see a lot of moonwalkers here who are sending different messages, and I think that is because they are in between the NATO agenda, which is escalatory, and if the situation in Ukraine and with their military industries were going better, they would probably even be more aggressive. And on the other side, they have their own people who have no idea why the hell are their armies already involved when it comes to sending aid and perhaps people. And they're especially not happy about the possibility of direct war between these respective countries and Russia. So that is why the politicians are jumping on the hot rocks and trying to somehow navigate between the agenda that they all have and their own population. So that is why we hear Scholz saying one thing, Macron another.
Well, Macron's name has been mentioned already. Anthony, let me go to you. The only thing Macron and Napoleon have in common is they were both small men. Other than that, there is no similarity here. Why is Macron mouthing off the way he does? Remember, at the beginning of all this, he was the dove. Now he's turning around and calling anyone that disagrees with him a coward. What's the evolution of Macron here?
Well, he's rolling back a little bit on what he said, because he's now saying that they're seeking peace. This is the role of peace. Yet encouraging the escalation is somehow encouraging peace, which is absolutely ridiculous. But the three of them, Macron, Scholz, and the German the Polish president, have all tried to unify, but in reality, you've got people like NATO Secretary General saying that what Ukraine needs is ammunition, and that's really quite an exaggeration, because the reality is throughout Europe, there's actually no unification at all. They're all speaking with different voices. You've got the EU president trying to say they're united when they're actually not. We've got a situation here where they're going to have to face the fact that the Ukraine has actually been losing this conflict for some considerable time. And how are they actually going to deal with that? But the added problem is there's a lot of elections European countries this year. Yep. And the key point about all of this is not one country have the public been asked their opinion. So none of these policies against Russia and supporting the current government in Ukraine have any mandate whatsoever from the public. And that's very key. And they talk about democracy. There's no democracy. There's all this warmongering, all this huge expenditure of public money without any authority from the citizens of those countries. And that's led in particular by the United Kingdom, who spent $12 billion so far, $12 billion, which is sorely needed in other areas. And at the same time, the sanctions against Russia have rebounded, and the UK citizens have had huge rises in the cost of energy and the cost of living, and it's a disastrous situation. But the public are not allowed to have an opinion on this. This is the thing. There's a lot said about the fact that people in Russia don't have an opinion, which they're allowed to put forward. In the UK, the media is so controlled that you can't have another opinion.
Well, you can have an opinion, it'll just be censored. Okay, that's their method now. Alexander, you know, we had the Latvian president in I refer to the Baltic Republics as the Baltic Chihuahuas on this program. He was quoted in saying, Russia must be destroyed. Well, isn't that nice coming from a little country like Latvia? And also we have other Baltic republics saying that the UK should return conscription. How do you react to that? It's nice that another country thinks another country should have conscription. What is Latvia going to throw into the mix here? I mean, how many U-Hauls full of weapons do they have? Alexander.
It's easier for them to say this. They are kind of catching the wave. And they remind me that classic case of the younger brother who tries to tease and bully everyone because he knows that he has an older brother that can go to his rescue in case of trouble. So it seems to me that the three presidents from the Baltic states or heads of government, they behave in this way because they know that they have someone on their back that will try at least not only to follow what they are saying, but at the same time to protect them and to confirm these words. However, Latvia not only has nothing, but we have also seen weeks ago that, for example, Denmark promised to send all the artillery they had to support Ukraine. And then you realize it's only 14 howitzers. So it's not much, but at least to the public audience, what they are trying to say is that we are giving whatever we have. Speaking of conscription, for example, I speak for knowing the situation in many European Union countries. It's easier to say for the Ukrainians to keep fighting until the last Ukrainian. But when it comes up to the situation where our own citizens should be deployed to the battleground, to the battlefield, then that's a whole different story. That kind of solution, usually the majority of the people do not support. We don't want to send our sons, our grandchildren to the war, but we want the others to fight for us. Because if you see, even from French president's words, what he says usually is we are going to deploy some military in somewhere in Ukraine. He was too vague. But at the same time, he's not saying that he's going to confront Russia, because he knows how unpopular such words would be understood by the French audience.
From what I understand, Alexander, it's 67-68% of French people polled do not want French soldiers going to Ukraine. Again, this is an elite agenda. You know, Stephen, one of the things, you know, when I look at these European leaders, and I don't know, I guess Macron just has an inferiority complex, or he's competing with Sergeant Schultz or something like that. We don't need political science. We need psychologists, I suppose, to understand these people. But, you know, the moralization, Russia must not be allowed to win. What does that mean, Stephen?
That means that they have a problem with the numbers and with reading what is going on the ground. But it is also a very dangerous path, because these words can eventually turn into moves which will cause escalation. The possible scenario that I see is that at the beginning you would have NATO forces that would enter Western Ukraine and practically police occupy, to be quite blunt. They would practically be occupation forces in Ukraine, in central and Western Ukraine, perhaps Kiev too. But the point of them being there would be to release all the policemen, all the a National Guard and other security forces of Ukraine to go to the meat grinder in the east. And that is how a slow escalation and slow, let's say, involvement that can actually become a larger
involvement. Stephen, you bring up an interesting point here. So if you're a Ukrainian soldier being sent to the meat grinder and there's some French guy sitting in a cafe in Kiev, what do you think he's going to think? My life is worth less than a French guy's? Stephen.
Yeah. Exactly. I think this was done from the beginning, but I think now they're starting to realize that on the front. You see that people are doing everything to try to not end up in the meat grinder. People are bribing the local military authorities. They're trying to rescue themselves by running away on the border, and they're being caught and then sent to the meat grinder. I mean, the dire situation of men in Ukraine is really something that should be called a humanitarian catastrophe, but it is not. I mean, this is against the war law. This is against any kind of let's say ethics of war. But that is exactly what we are seeing.
Well, I'm glad, Stephen, you brought up the word ethics here. Let me go to Anthony now. I mean, Lindsey Graham opined again. You know, he's complaining that the conscription age is too high. They need to lower it. We need to get these younger guys here. I mean, it's just amazing to see how Western politicians are willing to use Ukrainians as cannon fodder. And he always said, and no American troops. I mean, what a ghoulish way to approach things. Anthony.
Yeah, yes, it's terrible. And a lot of these so-called Western leaders have never actually had any military experience themselves. So they're quite happy for other people to take the risks, but not them and not their own sons and daughters. And it's a terrifying situation because the Ukrainian casualties so far are 1.4 million. That's dead, wounded, missing in action and captured. And I understand the Russian casualties about 288,000 equivalent. So the situation is untenable from the Ukraine point of view. And it's very much like the dying days of Nazi Germany, where people were starting to surrender sort of en masse, but there were a few diehard people around. But it's concerning that there are some people, particularly in the United States and indeed in the UK, who will be happy for the Ukrainian male population virtually to be wiped out just to satisfy their own sort of globalist.
Well, it's a bloodlust is what it is here. Gentlemen, we're approaching a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go to Alexander in Lisbon. Let's keep with this theme of NATO troops being sent to central Ukraine, western Ukraine, as an auxiliary force or something like that. Latrine, well, I don't know. But, you know, Is there a built-in assumption on the part of NATO thinkers, if that's not a contradiction in terms, that the Russians wouldn't dare to touch those troops? That's a pretty big assumption to have. Alexander.
Yes, to a certain extent, of course. The Russians, I don't see the Russians having the will or the intention to hit NATO's troops wherever they are, regardless if they are in NATO territories or if they are in Ukrainian, Western, Central, whatever. But at the same time, we have just to focus and to see what will be the mission of these NATO troops. Are they going to be deployed under only the French sponsor, being sponsored by the French, or are they going to Ukraine sponsored by NATO? This will be a decisive factor in order to decide and to understand how can the Russians deal with these forces. At the same time, because we have seen so far that there are a lot of military staff from NATO countries in Ukraine, not only gathering for meetings, not only for technical purposes, but they have been there and many of them have been dying in the battlefield. The problem is to see if they are going to attack the Ukrainian troops in certain areas or if they are going to start any kind of provocative action in order to force Russia to attack and then accuse Russia of attacking first place. But I don't see any kind of intention from NATO countries or even by France alone to start any kind of contact, of military contact or hostility with Russia.
But Alexander, if they're in the battlefield, they're in the battle space, what difference does it make? I don't think, you know, if these forces, whatever they're doing, but they're aiding and abetting a military to kill Russian soldiers. So they are the enemy as well. How could it be different?
Yes, the problem is if they publicly admit that they are on the ground, while at least to the present time they have never admitted, but they were in the battleground. They were in the battlefield. They were not only French, they're not only German, not Polish, but also from the United States. And they have been killed during confrontations. The problem is that it was not public. Now that they are assuming it being public, then they want to start to use it as being some kind of trigger in order to call, to provoke, to create any kind of tension or hostility with Russia.
Okay, talking about triggers. Well, then, Stephen, let's think about it logically. I know Western leaders don't do this, okay? But, you know, then, you know, we have the Article 5 come into play here, okay? I mean, if they're going to go into the battle space, okay, and there is a exchange, there are casualties, then they're in a stage of war. But then NATO cannot invoke Article 5 because they've already violated Article 1, that they would not go into a military conflict here. So, I mean, they're shredding their own logic and their own law. Go ahead, Stephen.
We are going into a philosophical discussion now, because what NATO has been doing for the last 2 years, if not much longer, is to get involved as much as possible into the war, but for the rest of the world to think that NATO is not in the war. So, for instance, Czech Republic has made its coalition for ammunition. So they gathered and deployed 800,155 millimeter shells from, they claim they bought it in South Korea and other countries. And other NATO countries are involved in this. However, they are pretending that this is not NATO, but that this is some kind of coalition of the willing. Remember that phrase from 2003 when Bush attacked Iraq? So it wasn't NATO, it was coalition of the willing. So what they are doing now is exactly that. NATO is already...
Well, Stephen, I can up the ante here. Annalena Baerbock, 180 degrees Baerbock, she wants to have somehow German missiles sold to the British so the British can send them to Ukraine. I don't know what kind of foolish
operated
games...
But
she, for some reason, not the defense minister, would be able to control coordinates. I mean, this is getting insane. Anthony, react to that.
Well, it is insane, and we've got a pretty insane new defense secretary, Graham Stats, who's likely to go along with that. But there are consequences for any country which gets so heavily involved in helping basically kill Russian soldiers. And in the UK, the UK's just lost a major fishing agreement with Russia, which is to do with the staple diet of many people in the United Kingdom, fish and chips. And we're going to see a skyrocketing increase in the price of fish in the United Kingdom because this has been withdrawn. And I think Russia has actually been quite moderate in its reaction to various European countries.
So, Anthony, let me just on this fish issue here. So the British public will be denied fish, but the Russian public will be able to eat fish. Yeah, how is that a sanction?
Well, all the sanctions,
don't get this. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, they've all rebounded against the United Kingdom. Nobody looks at the consequences of having such a policy because very rarely do sanctions actually work. But if we go back to the subject of people killed, there's already been 5,962 foreign soldiers killed in Ukraine. A good proportion of those have been the United Kingdom. And it's been a bit of a cover-up. And how much longer are the British public going to be denied the information? Because they're supposedly there to gather intelligence, to help with the training, to make sure the flow of arms is all okay. But in reality, they're helping direct offensive operations against Russian forces, and that's a matter of war. And there's been no parliamentary authority in the United Kingdom to conduct warlike actions against Russia. And already the United Kingdom government and many other governments are treading a very fine line with what they're doing.
Well, I suppose this is one of the applications of the rules-based order that we keep hearing about, okay? You break all the rules because we want to control, determine what is order. This is ridiculous here. Alexander, we have Speaker Johnson in the United States is talking about a standalone bill for more aid to Ukraine. I thought he had come to his senses, but he hasn't, of course. And interestingly enough, a Republican House controlled is going to give Biden a political win in an election year. Explain that to me here. But it's not going to make any difference. Anyone that knows, I've listened to a lot of military experts, and this is just way. Okay, of course, companies in the United States, they will benefit, but this is not going to benefit Ukraine.
To be honest, I think that even Speaker Johnson doesn't know what kind of a standalone aid package will this be, because his proposal still presents very vague terms. We don't know yet how is it even going to be submitted on a formal way, but at least it appears that he will try to push for some kind of single and autonomous proposal disconnected from any parallel concessions that to other political measures sought by Democrats and by Republicans.
Well, Alexander, it's been mentioned here, a new land lease. I don't even think the majority of congressmen even know what that term, historical term, is. How would that work? I mean, Ukraine is going to pay the United States back after all of this? I mean, either they don't know anything about history or they're just finding a new way to lie to people. Alexander.
It was kind of that for example, former President Trump this weekend just called for a kind of a loan, loan and lease. This simply just does not exist in practice. For example, even in the European Union, we have exactly the same aspect. We keep funding. We are going to fund Ukraine, and Ukraine will only start to pay back after 10 years, within 10 years. No one knows, and everyone at the same time knows, how will Ukraine is going to pay for
this? Well, I think there's a way that no one's thought about is they should tax Ukraine's oligarchs, because they're the ones that are making so much money off of this war. I mean, they should sign a personal loan. They're going to pay it back. Of course, it's nonsense. That's not going to happen here. We're rapidly running out of time. Stephen, I think we're in a kind of a turning point here. I think there's so much panic and desperation in the air that we have discussed on this program. What's the next step? Where are we going?
Well, I think that the West is only panicking and being desperate, because Putin said during his victory speech that Russia does not want a fake peace, which will last for a year and a half or 2 years, so that the military industrial complex in the Western countries gets ahead of the game, so that they can send enough weapons to the front line. So Russia wants a political solution. And I think the political solution with the current elites in the West and with the current government in Ukraine, or even Ukraine as such, is possible. That is why I expect Russia to secure its borders. And Putin again said that there should be a buffer so that cities in Russia are safe and secure.
Yeah, but Stephen, on this program, we've talked about this quite a bit, and my only concern is that I want an end to this conflict immediately, okay? However, Russia does not want to be put into a position where Ukraine rearms for 5 years and they start all over again. That's the problem. Keep going. Go ahead.
That is why West wanted the Korean scenario. To create North-South Korea situation in the middle of Europe, and Russia doesn't want that. It doesn't want to have a constant threat on its borders, but it wants to have a sustainable security architecture in European continent. And this is exactly what it was proposing some 10, 15 years ago, and what it was continuously proposing during the Minsk agreements and even until today. But they are not going to be willing to go for another fake agreement, which will only buy time for a second, let's say, punch that Russia should get from the West. So that is why I think it will inflict as much damage as it can, and it will probably solve this in military
terms. Yes, it must end where security is guaranteed for all. I don't know how we do that, but that's how it must end, or this will happen again. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Worthing, Belgrade, and in Lisbon. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.